This is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS.
BFBS, original Forces programs.
From mud through blood to the green fields beyond.
100 years ago, a special unit of mechanics, technicians, plumbers, and trapeze artists were brought together to break the stalemate of World War I. David Willey is the curator of the Tank Museum in Bovington, and he sets the scene as we sit in a tank as old as the battle itself.
At this moment, we're sitting inside the crew compartment of something called a Mark IV First World War tank. This is the tank we made the most of in World War I. About 1,000 of these were made, and this is the tank that is used at the Battle of Cambrai in November of 1917, and that's what we're going to be commemorating this year.
But very different from the tanks that were first produced. Who came up with the idea that a hunk of metal with men inside would be a good idea for war?
The tank is really a specific answer to a problem on the First World War battlefield. As we all know, Germany invades France and Belgium. Britain's got a treaty with the Belgians. We go out there with our very small but very professional army. There's a war of manoeuvre, but then Germany digs in and it chooses the best ground. It's fighting on the Eastern Front as well, so it sends some of its troops over there. Massive defensive lines it puts up. We're attacking. The onus is on us to push that occupying German army out. And so we're getting the casualties. So very quickly, actually in the First World War, by Christmas of 1914, they're starting to realise they need something new. And that's where we start coming up with some pretty barking mad ideas, big wheels that are going to roll over the battlefield. But they like the principle that you get some form of machinery to crush barbed wire, have some firepower on it, and some armour protection to protect the crew. So we come up with the first recognised tank is Little Willy. We've got in our galleries here that amazingly survived. That was like a testbed vehicle. It doesn't go and fight. And then by September of 1916, we're actually putting the first tanks into action. They're called Mark I tanks, and that's that classic rhomboid shape, the old school rubber shape, you know, we see in Royal Tank Regiment still has on its cap badge. They're the first ones. Very crude, very basic. Metal boxes, whopping great pre-war engines stuck in the middle of it. Armour plate will stop a bullet, not much else. But the whole idea, you're like a mobile battering ram. Crush the wire, let our infantry follow on behind. That was the idea of those first tanks.
How successful were the tests of the Mark I? Was it realised that we were onto a winner? Or were there some people scratching their heads as to whether it would actually be a goer or not?
Well, as with all these things, there's politics behind the scenes. The Navy, don't forget, are actually part of the design process. They're not talking to the Army. It's only a bit later on that the Army and Navy get together. Navy wanted what was going to be called HMLS, His Majesty's Landships. The Army later decides that's not a good idea because it gives away what, in terms of what the vehicle might do, a landship, you see. So what you're ending up doing, they decide to call it a tank. Part of that is a code word, because when you see Little Willy, it's like, you know, one of these big riveted tanks you get in your attic, so it looked like it's a water tank. The actual trials, they show off the tanks at a place called Hatfield House, north of London. They invite the politicians, they invite the military to come and have a look. There is the story that Kitchener, who's basically in charge of everything at the time for the British military forces, he walks away saying it's just some pretty mechanical toy. He may well have done that because he sees the potential and he doesn't want to spread actually the word around that we've got something a bit special here. And that problem that, again, we're going to have to face again perhaps in the future, which is where do you suddenly find capacity to build a fairly complex item like a tank in the middle of a war that's already going? So the Navy gets first dibs on factory space, ammunition, etc. The Air Force, the Royal Flying Corps is coming along, so they've got next priorities. So they're having to find things like agricultural workers or agricultural production companies like Foster's or Lincoln, some railway companies, to find the space to actually build these new armoured vehicles. And that causes a problem in terms of time, the energy that goes into it. When the first tank attack goes in September of 16, they had hoped for many more tanks being ready. Actually, they've only got 49 that they can ship off to France.
Now, I wanted to invite serving tank crew members to sit in the 100-year-old tank and share with me their initial reactions and thoughts on what it may have been like to do today's job at the Battle of Cambrai. Later, we'll hear from Lieutenant Richie Carter from the Royal Tank Regiment. But first, Corporal James Teese clambered inside the Mark IV. He's been in the Army for nearly 10 years and is now Challenger 2 Main Battle Tank Commander, having not stood still in his career.
I progressed from driver through to gunner, then to operator, then to commander. But I've had quite a broad career in armour, ranging from op-erics, using different vehicles, for example, Mastiffs. I used a Husky on my second tour to then go back onto main battle tanks later in my career.
This is the first time you've been in a Mark IV tank. This is one of the tanks that would have been in World War One. How does it compare on your first viewing?
There seems to be a lot more room in here for the crew, but I don't think that is the same. It's not in comparison with Challenger 2, and it's a different type of crampedness that we all get used to as crewmen anyway, but to have an exposed engine in the centre and weapon systems that fire off just solely strength and just pure skill, it's completely different to our modern technology now.
You're right by the gun. Tell me a little bit about what you can see.
So, yeah, with this, with one of the main guns on the side, then you can see here, we've got our main breech block. So if you were to compare that to a Challenger 2 these days, I mean, the main breech blocks are bigger than my torso itself on the Challenger 2, and far more heavier. And the fact we had to use a small crane inside to drop them and to use maintenance on them. With this being such a smaller main armament, it's probably slightly more easy for maintenance-wise. There's a lot more electrical equipment attached to our main armament in Challenger 2, which, like this, there isn't on this vehicle, which is actually quite nice because, in a way, there's less to go wrong. I'd imagine it was not as bad to maintain this weapon system as it can be on modern equipment from time to time. It's definitely got a striking comparison to a Challenger 2 main battle tank.
There's definitely no comfort in here. I mean, how does like the seating arrangement and the amount of room you've got to do the job you have to do, how does that compare?
Well, from a commander's perspective, I mean, there's still the seating up the front there, but from a commander's point of view, which is a nice, lovely, comfy seat in the Challenger 2, and it's a place you want to be, really, in the Challenger, other than the driver's seat, where he can pretty much get his head down for as much time as he wants. But when it comes to crew comfort, it's definitely improved over time. I mean, compared to this vehicle now, with exposed bolts and an exposed main engine, which should be, you know, white hot by the time you've gone about 5 metres, which just is a lot of risks to your crew. And obviously, with modern day technology and modern advances, it means that there's not as much risk and a lot more comfort in more modern vehicles. So it's definitely much more comfortable being in my tank than it would be in this one, I would imagine.
You've had, obviously, you've been through all the training that you possibly could do to get to where you are today. What do you think about the idea that many of the men that would have driven the tank, they would have been enthusiasts and not really, when they'd signed up, not really knowing what they were letting themselves in for?
Straight away, the bravery of them men is nothing that really can compare to anything we do these days. To go onto a vehicle platform that no one's ever seen before, it's never been trialled properly, it's just hastily put together to make that impact in the First World War, to then just decide, I'm going to be a crew member of that vehicle, which I've never seen before. I mean, straight away, the bravery of that individual is massive, and that selfless commitment to just get into the vehicle and do it is really quite impressive, really.
It's 1916. We had lost thousands of men in the battlefield. If the new landship was going to be part of Great Britain's success, who was going to build it and who was going to drive it?
So we start getting women into the factories, and of course in February of next year we'll be commemorating the fact that women are getting the vote. Before the war, much arguments against the suffragette movement. By 1918, no one is arguing against women getting the vote because we've seen their contribution to the war effort. And we've got pictures in the archive here. Foster's a Lincoln. Here's the blokes who are helping make the tank. But look, here's the great groups of all the women. And if you look at those photos, some of them you can see on their chest little badges. And it's because they're making tanks that literally it might be hubby, boyfriend, dad, an uncle is serving in that unit that might benefit from those tanks. So there's that real connection between, this isn't an abstract thing, you're not just making a bit of metal for nothing. This might help save my relative's life or protect some British soldiers. So that was quite an onus there, and they're very pleased and proud of what they were doing in terms of their war effort. So women are brought into the factories, we're using these various different factories where we can, and then of course we've got to find the men to crew the vehicles. And one of the things they do, they put adverts in things like the motorcycle magazine, have you got any mechanical experience? Will you volunteer? And we also get that the orders go round to other units saying, anyone there for this special unit? They don't describe what it really is, what you're going to be up to. And you get the usual situation there where sometimes the CO has a bit of a clear out of the dead wood. So you get a very mixed bag of some very idealistic people turning up, some amazing backgrounds. You've got all sorts of people with great experience and knowledge, and sometimes some really interesting, dodgy characters all turning up, being made into, they give it the code word, heavy branch machine gun corps, are the first guys that are going to serve on these tanks. And it's only later, after they've fought for the first time, they announce about the tanks, and the publicity grows about it, and then we end up with something called the Tank Corps in the following year.
Yeah, I'm Lieutenant Richie Carter of Cyclops Squadron, Royal Tank Regiment. I've been a troop leader in the regiment for over 2 years, having commissioned Sandhurst in April 2015. It's just amazing to want, as I say, it's the first time I've ever been in one of these, and I think it's amazing to just come in to just step, you know, almost stepping back in time. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit, probably, I suspect, a little bit cleaner, a little bit quieter than it used to be. It's amazing to just see the difference and see how far we've come, having, you know, been a Challenger 2 tank commander for 2 years or so, to then see, you know, this is what the tank commanders of the age would have been in, and to kind of imagine yourself in that age, yeah, it's really quite something to think about, really.
How do you think on the field this vehicle would have compared to what you drive?
The biggest thing for us, and it's quite a misconception really, that tank warfare, people have still got this image of modern day tank warfare as being quite slow and quite trundly, whereas actually, if you ever see tanks in combat, it's really, really kinetic, and there's a lot going on in the turret. It's a very busy turret, it's a very busy radio net. And I think this, just due to obviously the age it was, I mean, it's 100 years now since this has been rolled out, and this was the kind of stereotypical tank warfare. It's very, very slow, very, very lethargic. And so command and control was probably easier in that sense. However, when you think that they didn't have the radio equipment, they didn't have the digital equipment or the mapping that we have now, and you think, actually, you know, once the kind of flag went up and you guys were deployed over the line of departure, that was it, really, and you were kind of on your own. It was like, look out your periscopes, quickly see where everyone else is and try and follow them. There's none of this kind of quick battle orders on the battlefield. And I think it was a completely different style of warfare.
If you had to drive this now, where would your mind go?
So I think one of the main things for us is that in a Challenger 2, I mean, yeah, Challenger 2 is getting to that age now where it needs a little bit of TLC, it needs a little bit of care, but actually it's still an incredible piece of machinery, and we have absolute confidence in that machine. I think everyone in the regiment and everyone who is a tankie will say that we have absolute confidence in the Challenger 2 and its ability, and it's proven that many a time. I think the main thing for this is that it was untested, it was unproven, and even in the short time that they were kind of using it, they found it to be very unreliable and have a lot of problems, as you would with a machine of this calibre in the kind of age that it was in. So I think, yeah, I'd definitely be more nervous. And I think just the style of warfare has changed so much as well now. I mean, even being in a Challenger 2 in World War One would have been, you know, quite something, just a completely different style of kind of mass total war. The main thing for this, it was just completely untested, it was completely new bit of kit. And for the guys inside, as you say, they weren't necessarily professional soldiers like we have nowadays. They were guys that had been pulled together, like, often, like, just because they were good at fixing cars and stuff, and suddenly they're in a main battle tank, you know, rolling across the fields of Cumbria. And I think it's it does beg a belief, really, to think that was, you know, that people actually did that. And that's why it's so important for us to kind of remember what they did, because it was such a huge thing.
Forces Radio, BFBS.
Lieutenant Carter highlighted the excellent radio equipment on board today's Challenger 2, and we'd be right in thinking that comms maybe were a little more crude at Cambrai. Adam Forty is a military historian and the business development manager at the Royal Signals Museum in Blandford. He paints a picture for us of life in the tank and what the men would do if all modern communication failed.
The bottom line is you're in 28 tonnes of steel, travelling at about 4 miles an hour. No suspension, so any hole that you hit, you get flung about the compartment. You would be inside a small box body with a huge engine to your right. You've got two fighting sponsons, which would either have machine guns or six-pounders in, and eight crew. So you'd be in a very, very limited space with horrendous noise, shaking, banging, hitting lumps and throwing you about the fighting compartment. Each time the sponson, the six-pounders would fire or the machine guns would fire, the fighting compartment would fill with debris or certainly gases from the blowback from the shells firing, so you'd be in a smoky environment. As you were travelling through no man's land towards the enemy position, because you're travelling at 3 to 4 miles an hour, you are a wonderful, huge target for them to start firing at with all sorts of different things. The armour in a Mark IV tank is only between 6 to 12 millimetres, so it's not terribly thick. So what tended to happen is, as people machine gunned your tank, little bits would spit off the inside. So you would wear a leather helmet with a chainmail mask in front of your face to protect you from these bits of metal that were firing out inside the tank. So you're in a noisy, dusty, smelly, smoky environment, and then you've got to communicate. The way they communicated internally was potentially through a voice tube. So a bit like you see on the old ships, you'd have a brass tube going around the tank and you could blow into it and talk to each other. How much that was used in action, I suspect not a lot. And I think a lot of yelling probably went on. Although the amount of instruction was probably relatively limited, it would be engaging the enemy and making sure that you were heading in the right direction. That's internal communications. In terms of external communications, you again had two or three different options. On the top of the tank, they had a small semaphore system with two arms, which again could send messages, but how much that was used in the thick of the battle, I suspect not a great deal.
And couldn't have that been read by the enemy anyway?
It could, but you could code it quite easily, or have preset messages. So I'm informed by a living expert. My father was Royal Tank Regiment and was a director of the Tank Museum for 13 years. He told me that really it was limited to follow me, head in that direction, and fire on the enemy. So it was fairly limited, the tank-to-tank communications. Then you had to communicate back to brigade or divisional headquarters. And for that, there were wireless tanks, in theory. And again, in theory, depending on who you read, and as with all ancient history, everybody has a different opinion of how many vehicles went into action, what they were doing, where they went, etc. But in theory, 9 radio tanks were involved at Cambrai, although another book that I've read said that they actually never saw action. So it's really difficult to assess what they actually did. But I believe some of the vehicles got into action, but it was very limited what they could do, particularly with a wireless tank. My understanding is that generally the wireless tank would be almost off the corner of the battlefield, watching from afar and reporting back to divisional headquarters. So they weren't involved with the thick of battle. They would literally go in and sneak off somewhere, set up their aerial, and start transmitting information about what was happening on the battlefield. So this wasn't like a modern vehicle where you're going in, providing information whilst you're driving into battle, talking to each other on one radio net, whilst talking back to brigade on a different radio net. This was one vehicle set off to the side of a battlefield, perhaps one per battalion, and reporting back the action to brigade headquarters to tell them what was going on.
So would it have been down to a pre-planned organisation of where the tanks were going to go and where you were going to turn left and right that made the line of tanks go in the right direction?
Absolutely. If you look at the planning for Cambrai in particular, there was a very distinct pattern of advancing in certain formations into certain different areas, so everybody's action was pre-planned as far as it can be in the thick of the battle. The problem with any battle involving tanks in the First World War was the attrition rate getting to the battlefield and crossing no man's land. So for example, again, reading a variety of different books on Cambrai, there were roughly between 327, let's say 350 fighting tanks going into action, and roughly 180 of those didn't make it back out of the action or didn't make it into the action. And out of those 180 that were no longer functional in one way or another, only 65 of them were actually destroyed by enemy action.
With the British military, would they have learnt to improve the communications or the need to improve the communications after Cambrai?
Absolutely. World War One, in terms of communications, was a permanently evolving and learning process. And it wasn't just a learning process in terms of the techniques you used to use, but it was an evolution of the actual equipment, improving throughout the war from early spark transmitters using Morse code to eventually getting towards voice communication. Certainly from an aircraft, by 1917, there was actually voice communication happening then, sort of carry-away CW sets rather than these spark sets. And typically, in an armoured fighting vehicle, all sorts of things can go wrong. It would be difficult to set up your equipment. The equipment could go wrong. So they had the fail-safe. And the fail-safe was a little door in the side of the sponson out of which you would write a little message, you would put it in a little carrier, you would put it on your pigeon and allow it to go out of the tank. And that was a fail-safe communication system and a very effective way of communicating on the battlefield.
And that learning process was leading to meticulous, even scientific preparation, as what were known as Churchill's landships were given every opportunity to succeed in the quest to break the deadlock in France. Let's head back to the Tank Museum with David Willey as we look at the hours just before the Battle of Cambrai.
The end of every battle, they filled in a form, the tank crews had to fill in what worked, what went wrong, what can we do better about it? Because quite simply, that onus in wartime is if we don't get this right, we're going to lose more men. And even worse, let's just remember that bigger picture. If we fail, if we lose, and a militaristic Germany takes over Europe, these guys really are thinking they're fighting for liberty and freedom. So let's not diminish that any way. So these are very important things we need to get right. It is not an abstract problem. So that sense of how some of those first tank attacks, the tanks got lost, or they ditched before they got to the front line. So with Cambrai, we have reconnaissance officers from the tanks going ahead, making sure, laying out white tapes, making damn sure these tanks are going to get to the right position for the attack and not suddenly find themselves getting sunk on the way somewhere. So they end up putting supply dumps forward. They realise, hang on a second, if we can supply the tanks in the field, so they give a number of tanks massive great sledges to pull behind, so they've end up getting fuel, further ammunition they can take with them to continue an attack. We've got lots of different ideas. We know the Germans have purposely built the Hindenburg line trenches wider than the old traditional trench. How is our tank going to get across it? So again, very quickly they roll up their sleeves and think, what are we going to do about this? And they come up with the idea of the fascine, a massive bundle of brushwood, two chains around it, two tanks pull that tight, they put a bolt in, put it on the roof of the tank, and as you approach the German front line, you release your fascine, drops into the German trench, and you can progress across it. And again, so constantly, how's the cavalry going to come up behind you? We might have crushed down the barbed wire, the infantry can walk across it, they call it like a mattress sometimes, they were walking on this springy crushed barbed wire. Cavalry won't, the horse naturally won't tread on wire. So they end up getting some of the tanks, two per battalion, dragging behind them massive great anchors to rip up that wire, and then they'd separate and go in opposite directions to pull away all the wire from the ground and leave a space for the cavalry to go through. Again, so they're envisaging the problem, they're learning from their past experience, and again, none of this faffing around doing a feasibility study for the next 5 years. By that start date, we have got to get it ready. And again, you've got people like Fuller, who's working out the tactics for use with training with the infantry. You've got Ellis, who's in charge of the tanks, very inspirational leader. He's absolutely behind, and he realizes this is our moment, chaps, because if we don't prove our worth now on good ground, good going, we're in trouble. Okay, because actually there's so many other calls on the resources at home, on the army as a whole, we really need to seize this opportunity. And you can read that in the special order he gives out to the tank corps, special order number 6. He issues to the men beforehand, this is our time, he's saying, this is it. And then he says, look, I've done all my planning, I've done everything I possibly can. Little bit of inspirational leadership, he gets in one of those tanks. He actually walks down 6 in the morning, knocks on the side of a tank called Hilda, right in the middle of the front line, and says, I'm coming forward with you. So it's that sense. And he tells all the blokes he's going to be doing this. I'm going to be up there with you, so we're just going to make damn sure we don't make a cock-up of this in any sort of way. And of course, as we know, that initial attack absolutely works. It really has done what they wanted to do. There's a chance the Germans capture a couple of guys before, the night before. There is a bit of an alarm in the front line, but actually the secrecy worked. All this preparation got the tanks there, 470 tanks. You know, imagine doing that today, 470 tanks on about a 3-mile front battlefield. That is an awful lot of vehicles. The supplies, the ammunition, they've done all this, the logistics behind it, amazing. They get that last artillery gun in place to its pre-registration spot at 2 o'clock in the morning.
And on the day itself, a staggering performance of British military might with 1,000 guns in action.
We've got a series of lines that we're going to progress to. The first line we take very easily. We then have some problems in one or two places, a place called Flesquier Ridge, where the German anti-tank guns pick off. We think up to about 30 British tanks get knocked out. there's some issues there. But at the end of that first day, we are so staggered almost by our success. We're not used to it. We haven't got this sense of, now what do we do? You know, we perhaps lost some of that sense of momentum of all this preparation. We're not used to getting this level of victory at this particular stage of the war. What we've picked up is all that energy and effort on that first day, really, really worth it. And that influences what we're going to do the following year in 1918. And these fantastic battles like Amiens, where sometimes we use huge numbers of tanks, but sometimes we're much more flexible about manoeuvring them around, using that new artillery, using that air power. We're getting better at it. We've got to give the guys the credit, this learning experience they've gone through. Yes, we've had the losses at the Somme, at Passchendaele, but they don't just sit down and give up. They learn from it, and they put that into brilliant practice in 1918. And that's the thing we all must remember. Don't forget 1918, it's the British Army stuffing the German Army at Amiens that lead to that armistice. And there is a danger that we always in Britain, we look at our great losses, we look at Dunkirk, we look at Passchendaele, we look at that first casualties on the first day of the Somme. Let's give these guys the credit in 1918 about having experienced those losses, but they didn't give in. They learn from it and they actually come out victors, and that's where they need the pat on the back.
In a moment, we'll hear again from Lieutenant Richie Carter as he reflects on this important battle. But first, let's turn to Lieutenant Colonel retired Stephen May. He's the regimental colonel of the Royal Tank Regiment in Bovington.
The centenary of the Battle of Cambrai and celebration of the regiment's first 100 years is a time really to reflect on the tremendous example of our forebears. It allows us to consider the courage and bravery of our officers and soldiers in recent operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, in addition to all those conflicts that have taken place since the end of the First World War. And finally, it gives us the opportunity to look forward into the next century.
I think it's really important for us as a regiment and as kind of a collective group of tankies to actually remember what happened at Cambrai, you know, the first use of tanks en masse, to remember the efforts that went into producing tank warfare and ultimately the kind of sacrifice that people made on that day and kind of tank warfare from then onwards.
From mud through blood to the green fields beyond, the Battle of Cambrai, 100 years on. I'm Jason Herbert for Forces Radio, BFBS.